From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. So the Super Bowl was last week. It was fun, but we feel let down. And what's the solution when you run out of sports? How about more sports? Instead of paying attention to the news, we spent the week lolling around on the couch in a beer and Cheetos-induced coma. So we thought we'd better devote today's show to conversations with some of our favorite athletes. We're public radio nerds. We love it when the jocks come hang out with us.
We'll begin with Pete Carroll, who coached the Seattle Seahawks to an unlikely playoff berth this year. Before that, he won two national championships with USC. We spoke to him in the summer of 2010. Joining us were panelists Mo Rocca, Charlie Pierce, and Kyrie O'Connor. And Peter started by asking him about his coaching philosophy.
One of your theories, one of your maxims is always compete.
And, central theme in the program.
Right. And it's obviously appropriate when you're coaching football at the college or professional level. Are there any places, any times when it's like maybe okay not to compete?
No. Well, not as, yeah, sure. That's what we hope the other guys are doing.
Right. One of the things you talk about is when you're dealing with your players, you tell these stories, you try not to be negative. You try not to be the coach who yells and screams at their players. And that's been successful, but isn't that part of like the coach sort of stereotype, the mean guy, the Bear Bryant who yells at the players or in one case hits them?
Well, it's all in the tone. It's how and when you do it. There's times to yell. I get excited and have fun as much as anybody. But most importantly is we're teachers, and what we transfer to them has got to help them learn. So if screaming is going to help them learn, then we'll scream. But for the most part, helping them know what they need to do next with the very next step they take is more important than just letting out a big old blurt and yell. So, but there's times now, I promise you, we get after them pretty good.
Really? So you're trying to make it positive. Like, hey, next time it'll be really great if you don't screw that up again, for example.
There you go.
You're starting.
That's close.
That's close. I'm getting there. All right. You were dealing with the elite athletes, both in college and in the NFL. These guys are either professional or going to be professionals, hoping to be professionals. These guys have been succeeding at a high level. What can you say, though, to make them give that extra mile? How can you get them? I mean, you could scare the hell out of me because I'm small and weak, but how do you get them
Here's the point. What you do, it's about the preparation during the week that gets you ready to play. And when you have guys that have put in their work, they've done their studying, the idea is to get them to feel that they don't have to worry about what's going to happen. They've been so well prepared. So when it gets to game time, you're just trying to keep their emotions going so that when they get on the field, they're at their very best. It really isn't the last words you say. It's more the release that you give them to freely play because they're so prepared. They're so jacked up. These guys love to play. They don't need to be kicked in the butt in the way you're talking about with a speech. They need to be prepared really well so that they're so excited to play, they go out there and play the game like they're capable. Now, that's what's really important. The worst thing you can do is tell somebody that they got to play the best game of their life, and that you don't know how to ever control that. We want our guys to play like they're capable of playing longer than the other guys and outlast our opponents, and that's going to win a lot of games for you because you're not beating yourself when you do that.
Right. Now, you mentioned the players being jacked up. I remember, I have experience with football. I saw the movie musical Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and there's a scene in the locker room where they're all getting ready, and they're just jubilant. I mean, they're singing, they're dancing, they're really excited, and they go out on the field, and I don't know what happens at that point, but is that sort of what it's like?
Singing and dancing.
That's much more like it.
Well, let him answer.
No, you have a much better feel than the other guy does.
Yeah, fine.
As Amos Alonzo Stagg once said to Pop Warner, it's all the show tunes,
man. Yeah, I know.
Now, the players, do they still do that thing where they put the black stuff under their eyes?
Yeah, you know, I never knew what that was all about. I'm glad you brought that up.
Because, yeah, I always wondered because, I mean, do you put that on yourself or do you get a friend to put it on for you or is there, like, somebody on staff that's doing that? Or
It depends on the background of the guy.
Some of us bring our own.
That's right.
I've never understood. It's such a waste of time. Why don't they just tattoo a black square under each eye?
Well, as a matter of fact, they tape them on now. I don't get it at all.
They tape them on?
Yes. Yeah, with Bible verses and stuff.
Yeah,
well, I just
want to
say, I mean, can I say something about football?
You can say whatever you want, Mo.
That's what we're talking about.
He likes you best. Okay. Go ahead. You can do no wrong when it comes to Coach P.
Well, I just want to say that the one day I spent in JV football, I was very daunted by the big, tall, blue thing that you had to run into. And it just, just the words of Coach Fagan ring in my head that when I ran towards it, and I didn't hit it hard enough, and he said, "I'm not your mother, and that's not your sister."
Future Seahawk play-by-play man, Mo Rocca, today.
Are you worried? You've handled a lot of pressure. You've been in the NFL before. You were at USC, which is a pretty high-pressure environment for a coach. Now you're going to Seattle. Well, the whole region is going to be pinning their hopes on you. They've been disappointed before. Are you worried about this? Are you worried about what might happen this time? Or how are you going to handle it if you are?
Bring an umbrella.
If I was worried about it, I wouldn't be doing this. I'm excited about the opportunity and looking forward to it, you know, and the challenges of it. This is the highest level of competition you can get, and the way they've supported, you know, our change in the coaching staff and the way we're going after this thing is really special and unique, so I'm really pumped up about it, and we're going to take it as far as we can take it.
And just to, on that note, when you moved to Seattle, did you rent or buy?
I learned a long time ago, rent first.
Yeah, I guess so. One of the things that's different in NFL than in college is in college you're obviously responsible to an alumni community and the owner, not the management of the university, the president, the athletic director. With football, you're generally responsible to one very rich guy who's gotten his own way his entire life.
You mean like Paul Allen, who started Microsoft?
For example, Paul Allen, who owns the Seahawks. You've dealt with other people, Robert Kraft, who owned the Patriots. Is there any strategy you need for dealing with extremely rich, powerful men?
Yeah, do whatever they say.
Yeah. Coach Pete Carroll, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
That was a great monkey shot with the 5-bar.
You are an acclaimed and successful football coach. You know everything there is to know about football, but change one letter, and then where are you? We're going to ask you 3 questions about foosball.
Foosball?
Foosball. Foosball. Foosball is the tabletop soccer game, you know, with the guys on the stick you turn.
It was my minor in college.
Was it really? Oh, yeah. All right. We're going to ask you 3 questions about that game. Get 2 right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Calls for us on their voicemail. Carl, who is legendary coach Pete Carroll playing for?
Pete is playing for Braxton Emmy of Youngsville, North Carolina.
All right. You ready to play?
Right. Yeah, let's go, Braxton. Here we go.
All right. The game is called foosball, mostly here in the United States. Over in France, where some say the game was invented, it is called what? A, baby foot. B, conjoined soccer. Or C, homme très petit avec les boules très petites. Or tiny men with tiny balls.
That's D, Bob. Tiny men with tiny balls.
You're going to go with tiny men with tiny balls. You do spend time in locker rooms, I can tell. No, actually, it's baby foot, sadly, is what they call it. Baby foot, they call it in France. That's no problem. You still have 2 more chances to go, and I know you thrive in adversity. Hey. Now, here we go. Like any sport, foosball has its own slang. When somebody scores a cheap point against you, you're supposed to say what? You say, A, I hear birds, because birds go cheap, cheap. You say, B, you dinked my rod basket. Or you say, C, clapper trapper.
I'd say spin this.
Aha! Uh-huh. No, it's one of those.
I go C.
You're going to go C, clapper trapper?
Clapper trapper.
Guys in frat houses all over America yelling clapper trapper at each other? You think?
I don't know. I'm going with it.
You're
going
to go with clapper trapper. No, I'm afraid it's I hear birds. You say I hear birds.
No way.
Birds
no are cheap. Way.
It's kind of a passive-aggressive way to complain, but, you know, whatever. All right, you have one last question here. Let's see if you can get this right. There are all kinds of foosball tables available, including which of these? You can get one of these kinds of a foosball table. A one-to-one scale table in which the men on the rods are actual men. B, a FIFA-inspired version in which the little men can fake an injury by randomly detaching... from the rod at key moments, or see a, quote, hardcore version in which a goal results in a powerful electrical shock being sent to the opponent's hand.
I'm going with the flop, B.
You're
going
to go with the flop. Did they flop over? That would be great, but actually it's A, the one-to-one scale, real-life people. It's called human table football. It's a big inflatable field in which 10 people are strapped to poles and they try to kick the ball past each other. It's used as a corporate team-building event, Coach, in case you want it for one of your practices. That might be
wait, wait,
great.
So real people are strapped to the bars?
Yeah, well, what, yeah, they're basically it's this huge thing. It's inflatable.
Can you spin them all
yeah,
the way around?
No, I don't yeah, think. Exactly.
I think that would be great. It'd be good, but no, they can't move, I think, is the fun. And they have to just kick the ball where they can reach it.
Oh, jeez.
How does this differ from stuff Caligula used to do?
I don't know. Carl, how did Coach Pete Carroll do in our quiz?
This is one time the coach was not a winner, Peter.
Oh,
no correct answers.
Pete Carroll is the new coach of the Seattle Seahawks. His new book on his philosophy is called Win Forever. It's in bookstores now. Pete Carroll, thank you so much for playing with us.
Thanks, guys. That was a lot of fun. See you.
Take care. This week, it's an all-jock edition of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as we fill in that mid-February sports drought with our favorite athletic guests.
Can you smell the testosterone?
Next up, former NFL player Joey Harrington. He is our favorite quarterback ever because while he may not have the stats of a Montana, a Brady, or a Manning, none of those guys ever called us up and asked if they could come to Chicago just to be on our show.
We had always dreamed of being asked out by the quarterback. Joey, then with the Atlanta Falcons, joined us in February 2008, along with panelists Adam Felber, Luke Burbank, and Paula Poundstone.
Let's talk about the joy of playing football, because one of the things we've noticed is they've got these new cameras now that can swoop down on the field. I'm not quite sure how they do it, so you're getting more of a sense of what it's like for you guys on the field. And when you get a sense of it, it seems like you as the quarterback are faced by, given the play and the defense, anywhere from 5 to 9 extremely large, angry men who very much want to kill you now. So how do you avoid doing what I would do, which is falling to my knees and weeping? I mean, honestly.
Which is a trick play that worked back then. Yeah. 77 for the Steelers, yeah, I think.
The statue of sobbing.
I think as a quarterback especially, you learn at a young age that you're going to get hit. I mean, you're going to end up, you know, I want to say it's a lesson that a lot of kids learn when they're playing Pop Warner. You get a ding, you get, you know, hit in the leg, you get a little, you know, an ouchie, and you come off the sideline, and your coach says to you, are you hurt or are you hurting? If you're hurt, you know, we're going to
get you. Was Dr. Phil your coach?
Yeah.
You need to ask what Joey wants here.
I got to ask about this. You, of course, played for the Falcons last year. They had an interesting year.
You think?
You started as the backup to Michael Vick. Then he became otherwise engaged. And then, of course, toward the middle of the year, your coach quit. It must not have been a lot of fun last year.
The thing that I've learned through 4 years in Detroit, and mostly in 4 years in Detroit, is you worry about what you can control. But 17 more days. I mean, just take a deep breath for 17 more days.
Well, if I remember the story, he had promised everyone, the owner, everyone, he was not going to quit.
His words were, "I am your coach. You have a coach in me." And after the game, he said...
Not a coach of your team.
Yeah, exactly, right, exactly. Right. He said, "I want you to go home and take... Everybody to go home and take a look at themselves in the mirror and ask what you can do to help make this team better." And apparently what his decision was to make the team better was to leave.
Yes, well...
And so...
Did he take his ball and go home, or he just left?
You just needed to ask him. You just needed to ask him, are you hurt or hurting?
Yeah. He was hurting.
Yeah. He was hurting, yeah. Clearly. Well, speaking of people performing at the pinnacle,
Joey Harrington, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling
Happy Smurf Day.
As I'm sure you know, we assume that you and the rest of your teammates on the Falcons have been counting down the days. This October marks the 50th anniversary of that international cartoon phenomenon known as the Smurfs. Yes, it was a short half century ago that the little blue shirtless creatures appeared in a French comic book. So we're going to ask you three questions about the Smurfs. If you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is quarterback Joey Harrington playing for?
Peter, Joey is playing for Judy Donahue of St. Paul, Minnesota.
All right. First question for you, sir. How did the Smurfs inventor, cartoonist Pierre Culifort, come up with the name Smurf? A, he was trying to describe the sound a mushroom makes when you step on it. Smurf. B, he asked somebody to pass the salt, but he forgot the word for salt and just said, pass the Smurf. C, it's an acronym for a French phrase meaning, roughly, charming little creatures in white underpants.
I'm going with the underpants.
You're going to go with the acronym. Smurf is an acronym.
Wait a minute, hold on. I gotta.
The crowd
groan.
Went, ooh.
Yeah,
the
that
crowd went, ooh.
Somebody reacted with physical pain to that.
I'm gonna Price is Right. What should right. I be? Pull the audience. What do we got?
No. Yeah.
No.
Do you turn to the audience and the stadiums in which you play and say, so what should I do in this play?
Should I throw it to
that guy? No, you're on your own.
I'm
in the
sticking with my gut. I'm going with the white underpants.
Really?
Yes.
You should have listened to them. You were wrong. It was. No, what happened was it was the B. He asked somebody to pass the salt.
Oh, you're not so smart now, are we?
Yeah.
They were going to send you to A, weren't
fact,
they?
Yeah, I saw a lot of number ones in the audience.
Stepping on a mushroom, people?
I should point out that he didn't say pass the Smurf. He said, pass the Strumpf, which in French is what you call a Smurf. In German, they're Schlumpfs. In Spain, they're Pitufos. And in China, they're Nam Ching Ling. Second question. Recently, a brand new film about the Smurfs came out with the help of the UN. It was made to advance a message. What happens in this film? A, the Smurfs meet with other forest-dwelling creatures and agree on tariff rates, just like in the European Union. B, the Smurfs, who are, of course, blue, deal kindly with the new race of pink Smurfs who immigrate to Smurf Village in order to do low-wage jobs. Or C, the Smurf Village is carpet-bombed.
C.
C, you're going to go for C? They were carpet-bombed?
I'm getting...
You're getting good vibes?
I'm getting good vibes from someone in the... Yeah.
You think
the guy in the glasses over there is telling me C, and I have no idea. So I'm going to...
You mean that blue guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, that little blue guy with white underpants.
I believe his name is Brainy.
Brainy Smurf. Well, you or he are right. They're carpet-bombed. The 25-second film made with UNICEF as a public service message shows the Smurf Village being bombed with Smurfs running fruitlessly for shelter. It ends with baby Smurf crying in the wreckage. Really? Oh. Then a captain comes on and says, quote, don't let war destroy the world of childhood.
Smurf. Wow. That's unsmurfy.
And here's the funny thing. It's unsmurfy. Here's the funny thing. What did they expect? People would watch this and they'd go, yeah, gosh, I guess I won't bomb that village. I mean, I don't know. All right, but you've gotten one.
Certainly stop my hand.
Yeah. All right, here we go. This is for all the marbles. Lastly, over the years, as the Smurfs have become ubiquitous all over the world, there have been some very odd conspiracy theories advanced, sometimes quite seriously, about the Smurfs, including which of these? A, that the whole Smurf saga is meant to be pro-communist propaganda. B, that they were originally inspired by a trip on magic mushrooms taken by the author, which explains their mushroom homes. Or C, that in the original French version of the comic, now lost to history, the Smurfs had visible body hair. One of these is a myth about the Smurfs.
My guy in the audience is giving me a shrug right now.
Yeah. You're out here by yourself, man.
I'm on myself.
Yeah. He's quickly shaving his body.
Another coach just quit on you.
And he said he'd be there for all three questions.
17 days, man. 17 days. You couldn't wait.
All right.
You know, actually, I think I've actually heard the theory of the communist.
The pro-communist propaganda?
Uh-huh.
You're right, sir. Well done. Woo-hoo. Woo-hoo. Carl, how did Joey Harrington do in our show?
Joey's a winner here. Peter, two correct answers, and he
wow.
wins.
Wow. There you go. Yeah.
Judy Donahue.
Joey Harrington is a veteran NFL quarterback. Joey, thank you so much for being here with us. What
My
a great
pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen.
In the world of sports, there are two kinds of people, those who play and those who wish they could play, but can't, so instead end up writing about sports instead.
Buster Olney is a frustrated former Little Leaguer who's become one of the best writers in the baseball beat. He joined us in April of 2010, along with Tom Beaudet, P.J. O'Rourke, and Paula Poundstone. And I asked him if he had always been obsessed with baseball.
Yeah, I was always interested in baseball, despite the fact that I came from a family where everyone else hated baseball. In fact, when I was 10 years old and played Little League for the first time, I already was a burgeoning nerd and would come back from my games and stand in the kitchen and recite for my mother all of the plays and every pitch and every inning. And that after about two games, my mother said to me, "Buster, you have tremendous potential to be very boring."
Congratulations, sir, for living up to that potential. So, then this is a question for me because I'm a big baseball fan, but you actually get to know these guys. You're around professional baseball all the time. Does being that close to it ruin it for you as a fan? Can you know too much?
Well, not really. You know, I love the games on a daily basis, but you do have certain moments where it's not quite what you expected. A few years ago, Red Sox and Yankees, remember they had that big fight during the playoffs and Pedro Martinez threw Don Zimmer to the ground.
Oh, yeah. I just want to clarify for the audience. Pedro Martinez at the time was a 30-ish pitcher for the Red Sox. Don Zimmer was a 70-year-old man, a coach, kind of large and fat and bald, if I can be so bold. But go on.
So I ran down to the Yankees clubhouse to position myself to be the first reporter into the clubhouse because I wanted to be in the best possible position to talk to Don Zimmer after that game. And sure enough, I was the first guy through the door, raced over to Don Zimmer's locker, stood right there in front of the locker, and a wall of reporters came running in behind me. And even if I had wanted to move, I couldn't have. And so I was in the perfect position, and then I look over, and here comes Don Zimmer out of the shower. And he's got a towel on, and he gets in front of his locker, and he drops the towel with his backside toward me and bends over. And now, I've known Don Zimmer a long time, and I don't think he was trying to moon me, but he got the job done that day.
Yeah.
That was probably the most memorable day of my time as a reporter.
I think I could never watch a baseball game again after that.
Can I ask you a question? Is there a point at which you've said everything that can be said about baseball?
Absolutely not. There's a new game, a new story every day.
Yeah.
Well,
you sound like my mother, Paula.
No, I don't find you boring at all, by the way. It's baseball I'm concerned about.
Whenever we hear people talking about baseball, though, they're always saying the same things. If a guy's hitting, they say, well, he's seeing the ball well. You know, well, if the pitcher's pitching, he's really executing his pitches. Or he's not executing his pitches. And we all nod and listen.
That's why I talk about Don Zimmer mooning people.
Exactly. It's more interesting.
But isn't there always the possibility of the miraculous thing? Like the Yankees turned a triple play this week. They haven't done it like in 40, 50 years.
That's exactly right. And every day you could see something you haven't seen before. Opening day, you know, the Braves rookie outfielder Jason Hayward, 20 years old, hits a ball 461 feet in his first at bat playing in his hometown. That's a pretty cool moment.
That's why we watch,
Paul.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. It all comes clear. All comes clear for Paul.
One last question, and I say this as someone who loves baseball, talking to someone who really loves baseball. Do you ever, with all the work that you do, ever get up in the morning in the middle of the summer and say, you know, the last thing in the world I want to do is watch another baseball game?
No. Sadly,
really?
No. No, that's like my mom said, you know, tremendous potential to be very boring.
And there you go. Congratulations on living up to it. I'm sorry, that came out wrong. Well, Buster Olney, we're delighted to have you with us. Enough about that game. Let's play ours. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Reports of his death are not exaggerated at all.
Samuel Clemens, known as Mark Twain, died 100 years ago this week, inspiring many celebrations of his life and work. We're going to do our own by asking you three questions about the lesser-known aspects of his life. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is Buster Olney playing for?
Buster is playing for Jess Muse of South Portland, Maine.
Ready to play?
I'm ready to go. Another New Englander.
There you go. All right, square up your bat. Hope you're seeing the ball well. Here is your first question. Mark Twain went to great lengths to sell his books, including which of these schemes? A, he dedicated one to John Smith, not because he knew or liked a John Smith, but because he figured there were lots of them who would buy the book. B, he had an early edition of Tom Sawyer printed to look just like the Bible. Or C, the hardcover of Huckleberry Finn was sold as, quote, a story and a flotation device.
I'll guess A.
You're going to guess A. He dedicated it to John Smith? Yes, he did, in fact. It was the first published story, the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County. Very good. Here's your next question. Twain was an enthusiastic, if unsuccessful, businessman. He started a publishing house, which made a lot of money on President Grant's memoirs. But then he lost it all when he gambled the company on what failed blockbuster follow-up? Was it A, an enormous book of a new fad from Britain called Crossword Puzzles? B, an exhaustive biography of Pope Leo XII, or C, a catalog of the insects of the American South?
Wow. I am going to go C.
You're going to go C, a catalog of the American Southern insect species. No, it was actually Leo XII. Apparently, nobody really cared about Pope Leo XII. Twain only sold 200 copies and went bankrupt. All right, this is very exciting. Bottom of the ninth. Here you go, two outs. If you get this one right, you win. Twain loved technology. He was an inventor himself. Among his inventions was which of these? A, a new and improved kind of suspenders for pants. B, a cigar holder that holds and blends the smoke of two cigars at once. Or C, a fishing apparatus that involved small explosive charges.
I'm going to say C, given his time on the water.
You say fishing apparatus, like you throw in a little bomb with a reel attached to it or something like that. That's what you think?
Yeah.
No. It was the suspenders. I'm sorry. Yes.
A swing and a miss.
Yeah. There is no joy in Bristol.
You know, I'm going to go watch a baseball game.
Yeah. That'll make you good. No, Twain patented a, quote, improvement in adjustable and detachable straps for garments to replace plain old suspenders. So, Carl, how did Buster Olney do?
Well, Buster needed two correct answers to win for Jess Muse. He had just one.
Okay, Buster, I'm going to turn the table on you a little bit. So now you're doing your post-game press conference, and we want to know why you lost. What happened out there, Buster?
I totally choked.
Yeah.
See, I was given advice by a pitcher named David Cohn of the Yankees. He said, when you have a bad game, just say it. And then there's no other question that can be asked. So I just stunk up the joint.
Why do you think that was?
And how does it feel?
How does it feel?
Yeah,
I'm a loser.
Well, Buster Olney is a senior writer for ESPN Magazine. He's a regular on ESPN's Baseball Tonight and the author of the best-selling book, The Last Night of the Yankee Dynasty. Buster Olney, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. This week, we are reliving our glory days of when we had really cool athletes on the show. It's what passes for sports nostalgia among public radio people.
Well, I bow to no man when it comes to being the king of cool, but I might make an exception for Kelly Slater, who some believe is the greatest surfer who ever lived. He joined us in 2009 with Mo Rocca, Roy Blunt Jr., Amy Dickinson, and guest scorekeeper Corey Flintoff.
Now, people, and I speak from experience, they have a hard time in their first time surfing. It's hard to get going. Was it hard for you, or did you just leap right onto it? Was it natural for you?
I was just young. You know, I basically, as soon as I could walk, I was at the beach, and my dad surfed, so I just kind of followed suit, and I think it was just kind of second nature for me. But, you know, I have friends who started when they were, like, 40 years old, and it's definitely, there's definitely a learning curve, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Tell me about it.
I don't understand how you stay on the board.
You push against the water, it pushes back. That's the basics. But
so there's no Velcro involved?
No.
No, there could be.
Hey, we've just been talking for a little while, but I can't help but notice you do not talk like the stereotypical surfer. You have not said dude once.
Well, the stereotypical surfer doesn't talk like the stereotypical surfer usually.
Really? So I mean... So,
I do say dude, but I say it in, you know, it's like, you know, I'm probably not going to cuss on your show, but in, around the right friends I would, you know. So it's really an environment that creates that, you know.
Right.
I'm sure that in my life I've said, dude, that is so gnarly.
Mm-hmm. Really? You have?
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean, then?
Well, hello, man, fellow man.
Yes.
That was difficult.
Wow. It just occurs to me, you can act as a great ambassador from the surfing world to our world. You can translate. Now, it just so happens that I've got three daughters, and they tried surfing, and they loved it, and they're going to try it again, so they want to be surfers. And I want to get your advice, not so much on surfing per se, but on, like, surfing culture. How do you handle yourself? Do you want to carry yourself like a surfer? Remember to do what?
You know, I think it's just basically being respectful of other people when you're in the water. So if someone's been waiting longer than you for a wave, you generally let them have the wave. You know, just try to stay out of people's way. And,
you really do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Unless you're bigger than the other guy, then it doesn't matter.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
All right.
You have problems with jellyfish or sharks or anything like that?
G-strings.
G-strings are a problem for you? In what way are they a threat to you, Mr. Slater?
They're distracting.
Yeah, well. So you're a man who spends an awful lot of time in the water, so when you're out of the water, when you can't surf for whatever reason, do you start to go nuts?
A little bit. You know, for me, it's like a withdrawal. You know, that's probably the best analogy, because for me, it's almost like torture if the waves are good and I can't surf.
Right.
If the waves are really good and I'm not able, for some reason, to surf, I probably act like some sort of, like a fiending drug addict or something.
Really? Since you spend so much time in the water, any tips for combating pruning?
Pruning?
Yes. You know, your fingers get all pruny and unattractive.
It's the fingers you're worried about?
Yeah, well... well, you know, you can give any helpful tips you have if you have a lifetime in the water.
I don't know. Get out of the water.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, Kelly Slater, we're so delighted to have you with us, and we have asked you here today to play a game we're calling...
Surfing's great, but are there nachos?
So you're the best in the world at surfing, but we wondered how much you knew about the real sport of kings, that is, bowling.
Mm. Oh, you want some of this?
I want some of this, baby.
All right.
I've heard you're competitive. Let's see. Answer three questions, or rather, answer two of three questions correctly about bowling. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's voice on their home answering machine.
I'll give you a very brief history of my bowling life.
Please, let's hear it.
I used to be on a bowling team in high school.
Yeah.
And we were called the Dudes.
Mm. Foreshadowing.
And I once bowled a 28.
No.
Here's what happened. I bowled a 29.
Yeah.
And it ended up in a surfing magazine. I think I was 17 years old, 16 years old. And in the surfing magazine, it was written that I bowled a 28. And I was kind of mad about it because it was a 29. But I have since bowled a 225 once.
Oh, and, wow. All right, look, before we move on to the game. Bowled a 225. Is there anything that you can't do well?
Well, throw your three questions at me.
All right, we'll see. Yeah, okay,
we can start there.
Let's see. Okay. Well, Corey, who is Kelly Slater playing for?
Lisa Findlay of Mountain Brook, Alabama.
All right, here we go. Here's your first question. Bowling is popular everywhere, but only in America is the game played with 10 pins rather than 9. Why? A. 9-pin bowling was banned in America in 1870 because of the gambling associated with it, so bowlers simply added a pin to get around it. B, that's how many pins that could be found in New York City on the day of the first tournament in 1722. Or C, as the organizer of the first professional bowling league in 1905 said, 10 is better than 9, and America is better than Europe.
Hmm. Ooh.
Wow. I'm not so sure about B, where only 10 pins could be found on the day.
Right.
So I might strike out B.
You really don't like to lose, I can tell.
I'm going to just say C.
You're going to go with C, that they simply were being jingoistic. 10's better than 9, America's better than Europe.
But I don't know, there was the whole prohibition thing and all that, so that would make sense too. I'll go with C.
You're sure about that?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm afraid it was A. It was nine pins.
It was A.
Gambling, yeah. They added a pin to get around the ban on nine pins. All right, this is not a problem. You have two more chances.
I have to bowl a 300 from here on
exactly.
out.
All right, here we go. Why is Mike Capa of Racine, Wisconsin, a famous figure in the history of bowling? Was it A, he was the first person to drill holes in his ball after he kept dropping the thing on his foot?
Oh, that's fun.
B, he got the lowest score in the history of organized league play, a 2. Or C, he is believed to be the first person to throw a strike while holding a beer in his other hand.
Oh, no, this is so much fun.
Honestly, I don't care if I get this wrong. It's C.
Really? You're committed to that lifestyle choice? You don't care if it's right or wrong?
Yeah.
How committed are you?
I've come out of the closet.
How committed are you to making that statement?
I'm committed 100% because that just needs to be right.
All right. I wish it were. He got the lowest score ever. It was 2.
Oh, God.
He bowled 18 gutter balls, just knocked down 2 pins.
Oh, my God.
2. Lowest score ever in organized play. But you still have one more chance here. Here we go. Last question. In 1872, one Lucille Perk of Cleveland, Ohio, decided to go to her regular bowling night instead of doing something else. What was it that she turned down? She decided, A, not to compete in the Munich Olympics. B, she decided not to have dinner with President Nixon. Or C, she decided not to go to the hospital to deliver her baby, which ultimately happened between games 2 and 3.
What was her name?
Her name was Lucille Perk.
Lucille Perk.
Yes, Perk.
Gosh, that sounds like she skipped out on the president. You know, he can't get in the way of a bowling night.
Is that your choice?
Yeah.
You're right. She decided not to have dinner with President Nixon.
Yes.
Mrs. Perk was married to the mayor of Cleveland. He had been invited to the White House, but Mrs. Perk decided she had better things to do. Corey, how did Kelly Slater do in our quiz?
Kelly got 1 right.
I like this. I like this because, frankly, you're too perfect as it is. Yeah. And now we've discovered that you have one little weakness. That's it.
I will tell you, I was very nervous leading up to this because I'm thinking, gosh, I'm the only surfer to do this, and I could look really stupid here. And the stereotypes would all just come flying out of the closet.
Yeah, you get to travel the world surfing and playing golf in the company of beautiful women, and we're all sitting here going, he's dumb. That's what we're thinking.
Who looks stupid now?
Yeah, exactly. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Kelly Slater, thank you so much for being with us. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Back in the 1990s, Monica Seles was the most dominant female tennis player the sport had ever seen, who changed the image of the women's game with her powerful strokes and, yes, her grunts.
We asked her about both when she joined us in 2009, along with Kiri, Tom, and Roy.
I wanted to talk about your book, of course. It's your memoir, Getting a Grip. And one of the things you talk about in your book is, of course, the fact that you were one of the youngest champions in the international tennis scene. And that's because, of course, you started very young. You started playing tennis when you were 6, 7 years old, even younger.
Yes, that's when I first picked up a tennis racket.
Right.
And I realized at age 12 that I was really good, and I was beating girls who were like 18 years old. And that's when I moved to the U.S. and really took up tennis full time. And I turned professional when I was 15 years old.
Right. But how did you know, or how did your father, who was your coach, know how good you were? I mean, was it obvious in the beginning? Were you, like, punching balls through walls? I mean,
I wish, Peter. No, I think I just had a natural talent. And my father was a fantastic tennis coach. He taught me some great fundamentals. And, you know, I was a hard worker, so it was a combination of a lot of things. And then at that age, I just realized that, boy, I'm pretty good at this, and this could make, you know, this could be my career one day.
You were an international sports star. I mean, you were incredibly famous. Was that hard when you were that young?
Well, it was just difficult to live in the spotlight. You know, I was 15 years old and I won my first professional tournament. I was number one in the entire world at age 17. So a lot of pressure comes with that. And, you know, people start right away commenting on if I cut my hair too short, if I gained a few pounds, they commented right about that. So it was, you know, the learning process growing up under the microscope of the media.
Your book has extraordinary stories of what you went through, your career, which had some remarkable ups and some remarkable downs and some remarkable struggles, but it doesn't have a lot of gossip. And frankly, I would like you to give us some now.
Oh,
I mean, because come on, beautiful people.
I don't like to gossip around.
I believe that the International Tennis Tour is just an absolute cauldron of intrigue, sex, betrayal, and you don't have to give me any specifics, but just tell me that I'm right.
I don't think so. I can't give you that satisfaction.
No, really?
As any job, it's a lot less glamorous from the inside than from the outside. I will tell you that, though.
I'll trade you some NPR gossip.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to mention one other thing. You mentioned this in passing in your book. Another thing that you were known for at the height of your playing days was, to put it bluntly, your grunting.
Yes, I know. And I wish I could get credit for it, but unfortunately, Jimmy Connors started it, and he grunted before I was even born. But
right.
I think
you did not invent the grunt. But people talk. I mean, is that something you tried to do, or were you?
Not at all. I've grunted since I was like 8, 9 years old,
yeah.
And I didn't even notice that I was doing it. And I think it was just unusual for people to see a female hit the ball so hard and really give it all into every single point.
Right. Do you ever grunt off the court?
I never noticed even a tennis match. You know, I still get it sometimes. People say, oh, can you grunt for me? And I'm like, I can't. This is just something I do when I hit the tennis ball. It's part of who I am. It's my trademark.
But you don't do it when you're trying to open a really stuck jar, for example. Do you ever play Wii tennis?
No, I've never played Wii tennis at all.
Really?
I mean, I really don't believe it. I like to play actual real tennis the same way that I love to eat real foods. You know, I don't believe in diet.
Right. Well, Monica Seles, we are delighted to have you with us, but we're not done with you yet. We've invited you here. We've invited you here for a game we're calling.
I'm sorry. I can't talk right now. I'm chewing my beer.
This year marks the 250th anniversary of the Guinness Brewing Company of Ireland, that wonderful maker of beer. And of course,
I'm in trouble. I can tell right now.
It's a key contributor, Guinness is, to the great Irish legend of amusing, poetic, rampant alcoholism. So we're going to ask you 3 questions about Guinness, its history. Get 2 right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl, singing Danny Boy, off key, on one of their home answering machines. Carl, who is tennis legend Monica Seles playing for?
Monica is playing for Lynn Pham of Beaverton, Oregon.
Ready to play?
Hi, Lynn.
There you are.
Yes, I am.
Here we go. First question. In addition to a good recipe for beer, Arthur Guinness, who founded the company back in the 18th century, he had a fine instinct for business, as evidenced by what? A, he first legally changed his name from Arthur Flats because he knew Flats beer would not sell. B, instead of building a new brewery, he simply leased an old one for 9,000 years. Or C, he created a cheap disposable keg which the purchaser could discard. Essentially, he invented the first beer can.
I know nothing about beer since I don't drink beer, but I'll go with A.
You're going to go with A. He changed his name from Arthur Flats, realizing that wouldn't sound good.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was actually B. He leased the brewery for 9,000 years. Mm. The St. James Gate Brewery has been leased by the Guinness Company since it was founded 250 years ago, and that means that in the entire 2.5 centuries of existence, the company has spent about $16,000, $17,000 on rent.
Hmm. Sorry, Lynn.
No, you still got 2 more chances. Are you going to give up?
Mm-hmm.
Come
no.
on. This is 3 sets. You're down 1 set. Come on.
There are 2 more to go.
I just want to say this, and I mean it in the best way. Try grunting.
Uh-huh. Oh, give it
could
a
help.
Toss.
Just
I'm
a little,
game
a little
for
intense.
It.
A little intense here. In some places, Guinness is known for the Guinness Book of World Records as much as it is for their beer. How did the brewery get into the record book business? Was it A, it all started just as bits of trivia they came up with to print on beer coasters, beer mats? B, be the head of Guinness created the book to settle a bet about which game bird was the fastest in the world, or C, it was inspired by an old joke, when you're drunk on Guinness, you're the drunkest man in the world.
I have to go with C.
You're going
to
go with C?
It just sounds too good to pass up.
It really is pretty good. You're going to go with that?
Yes.
No, it was B, sadly, the bet. In 1951, the managing director of Guinness was hunting in North Slob, Ireland. And he started to wonder what the fastest game bird was, and he realized there was no handy reference to figure that out. And then he said, gee, if there was one, I bet we could sell a lot of them. So they invented the book. All right, last question. You can pick this up. You can pick this last one up. Last question. The ingredients of Guinness are a closely held secret by the company, but we know one ingredient that might be the key to the black stuff's success. What is it? Is it A, fish bladders? Is it B, anthracite coal? Or is it C, hemp?
C.
You're going to go for hemp. It would make sense, I guess, but the answer is fish bladders.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
No, like many other British beers, you see, Guinness is filtered with a substance called isinglass that's made from fish bladders. The stuff is supposed to be removed in the brewing process, but vegetarians, anyway, believe that there are molecular traces of fish bladders in your brew.
Ooh.
Carl, how did Monica do in our quiz?
A rarity, Peter. Monica did not win this when she went down 3-love. So no prize for Lin Pham.
Monica Seles is a world champion tennis player, the winner of 9 Grand Slam singles titles. She was elected to the Tennis Hall of Fame. Her new book, Getting a Grip, is out now. Monica Seles, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's it for our radio version of Gym Class. Feel free to change out of your sweats and back into your street clothes. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kauffman Foundation, working to advance innovations in education and entrepreneurial success. Learn more at kauffman.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago, in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Goedeke writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Filarczyk and Mohammed Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. B.J. Liederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walterover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle. Thanks to all of our panelists and great guests. And thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR.